It is therefore safer to remove the parasite by other and slower means, although by so doing you wouldst have to allow it to go on absorbing for a longer time the vitality of the mortal. To draw it away suddenly would be like tearing away leeches that had fastened on the skin, and would be both painful and dangerous. You must therefore withdraw the parasite gradually, detaching one portion of its suckers after another by an application of the chemicals sufficient to partially paralyze them without destroying them. At the worst, the mortal will only suffer a temporary loss of his own powers, and you canst gradually give him back the vitality he has lost. If, however, a great many astrals cluster upon one unfortunate mortal, it becomes most difficult, if not well nigh impossible, to keep him free from them, since the means of affecting them might injure him also. This will show you why certain people with very magnetic auras must be guarded from all chance of such accidents, and why they would never thrive in cities, where on all hands are encountered the astral shells that hang around the dwellings in which they have lived. For it is a curious circumstance that the magnetism thrown off in earth life hangs about the house and belongings of a mortal, and attracts his spirit to it after death. And as it attracts his spirit, so also it attracts that astral envelope, which is in no sense to be confounded with the spirit. As the body decays, the astral decays also, but if it have absorbed an extra amount of vitality after the death of the body by feeding on the life of mortals, the astral will become endued with so much independent vitality of its own, that it will simply drift away from the decayed body and enjoy for a time an almost independent existence. A soulless, unintelligent existence, it is true, yet nevertheless an existence, for it will go on absorbing life so long as it can find anyone to fasten upon, and as the dwelling place of its mortal owner's earth life possesses a certain magnetic attraction for it, it will drift back there as a rule, in the first instance, and hang about the mortals who are in it a senseless, purposeless wraith of its former inhabitant, whose appearance to the eyes of a clairvoyant will suggest a horrible idea of what the ghost of a mortal may be like. Would it not therefore be well to prevent any chance of this happening by destroying at first the dead body and the undesirable astral appendage? If a mortal would know how to distinguish between the true spiritual appearance of his dead friend and that of his mere astral shell, let him observe that whereas the spirit is ever intelligent looking, and slightly smaller in features and form than he was in life, for the simple reason that the mortal body was like a second and slightly larger covering of the spirit, while the astral body was the third envelope and the larger covering of the earthly body, the astral is like the swollen image of the dead friend, with the ghastly, death-like look of death, and the dull, expressionless inanimation of a soulless, senseless, waxen image, capable of nothing but floating like a noisome weed upon the current of life around it. Such is the astral body after death has robbed it of a soul. In life, its powers are very different. Like the spirit, it can be detached from the mortal body, and can be projected to great distances from it. But while it will reflect like an image of soft wax, every expression of its mortal owner's thoughts, it is incapable of any independent thoughts of its own, or any action not dictated to it by the mind that has projected it. This duplicate of a man's personality would be visible to a clairvoyant of a very low degree of power, since it is almost material in its nature, and can be seen where the true spirit would be invisible. Hence the numerous instances in which such apparitions have shown themselves, sometimes at the actual moment of the death of the body, but most commonly just before dissolution has taken place, and while the spirit has still a conscious thought projected to the friend to whom his apparition appears. When death has actually taken place, the astral may appear, but it will be with the stamp of death upon its waxen features. The reason that the astral body most often appears at the time of death or in serious illness of the body, is because under such circumstances, the ties between the soul and its envelopes are greatly weakened, and any strong attraction can draw the astral body away. It is therefore in cases of illness that the astral is occasionally found following a highly magnetic person in the flesh, and leaving for the moment its own proper earthly envelope. Where this takes place, it greatly diminishes the chances of the sick person's recovery, and it is better that highly magnetic people who possess astral rather than physical magnetism, should neither officiate as attendants upon the sick nor go to visit them, as however kindly the impulse prompting them to do so may be, it does not prevent them from exercising this magnetic attraction over the astral body of their sick friend. If they add a constant anxious thought of the friend to the magnetic attraction, they will be almost certain to draw the spirit as well as the astral of that friend to them, in which case his chance of recovery will be very precarious, for though in cases of serious illness the withdrawal of the spirit alone often allows a more complete rest to the body, as in sleep where the soul is often absent from the mortal body with no injurious consequences, the withdrawal of both the astral envelope and the soul itself at the same moment makes the merely earthly envelope in great danger of becoming so drained of the vital fluid, by means of evaporation, before their return, that it is practically dead, and becomes incapable of serving again as a covering to the spirit. The ties between it and the spirit are so weakened that while it serves as a leaden clog to the soul that would leave it behind, its rigidity has become so great that the soul cannot again enter it. If the spirit only be withdrawn from the earthly body, the astral will go on absorbing life with which to recruit it as it lies in deepest trance, but it is indeed precarious for both soul and astral to quit the body of the flesh at once. Therefore let the sick be ever tended by friends, but by such friends as are not too highly magnetic, or rather whose magnetism is not of the astral degree, then they will give out vitality, which the sick can absorb, but will not at the same time attract the astral body to themselves. Some will scoff at these ideas and say they are chimerical, but can these wise scoffers say in what the life of a mortal consists, or of what nature that soul is composed of, which they speak so glibly as explaining all the wonders of immortality? Can they say what life is, and whence it comes, and whither it goes at the death of a mortal body? The projections of the astral body without the knowledge of the spirit may be termed involuntary projections. But you know that a mortal may also acquire the power of sending his astral body to any place or person he may desire to visit while his spirit is present in the mortal body, and in a perfectly conscious state, in quite another place. It is, however, only when the body is in a state of trance and the spirit quiescent that the astral can remain absent for any length of time, otherwise the waste of vital power that takes place when all the functions of the body are in active operation will cause the body to die, as we have shown, for lack of that vital fluid with which the astral body is destined to feed it. There is a prevalent idea to the effect that the astral body belongs only to the earth plane of life, but this is an error. Because astral matter is a distinct element in itself, it is found in every sphere in a more and more sublimated quality as it recedes from the earthly center, where alone it is found in any degree of intensity. It is the intermediate substance between matter and pure spirit, and in the spirit spheres the spiritual astral performs the same function of nourishing the spirit body of those spheres as the earthly astral performs for the earthly body. And astral spirit bodies are cast off along with the spiritual envelope when the soul departs for a higher sphere, just as earthly astral and earth body are cast off together when the soul leaves the earth. The true soul is therefore always clad in a triple garment, consisting of first the spiritual envelope that enwraps the soul itself and which is always of that higher degree of spirituality which belongs to the sphere immediately above the one in which the soul is enjoying its conscious existence. Secondly, there is the envelope belonging to the sphere of the soul's present conscious life, that is, either of the earth when on earth or of some of the spheres above or below, according to the soul's condition of progression. And thirdly, there is the astral envelope of each sphere, which serves, as we have said, to nourish the invisible spirit body, and to link it with the second and visible one. In casting off its dual envelope, therefore, the soul never alters any essential constituents of its individuality, it only passes into a more sublimated form of them, retaining the most spiritual portions of its former state in each succeeding one, and passing always into higher and ever higher forms of sublimated matter. From certain classes of vampires, the protecting spirits can guard man in a certain degree, but from such as Jalaluddin it is well nigh impossible to do so once he has established a complete rapport with his victim. meant see the things of the spirit world so imperfectly as a rule that it is not to be wondered at that they have confounded the three classes of astral vampires. There'll be some mortals who even in life are unconscious vampires in a modified sense, because from the strong absorbent powers of their astral bodies and their own natural tendency to retain rather than give out again a corresponding amount of their own magnetic vitality, they draw from those with whom they mingle an undue proportion of their life, and with very sensitive, delicate persons they draw so much away, that while they flourish exceedingly themselves, the poor person whose vitality they have thus sucked out fades and often dies, without either the victim or the unintentional, unconscious mortal vampire being aware of the cause. More especially is this often the case where the vampire mortal is old, and in need of a constant supply of vital fluid, while the victim is young and full of fresh vitality. This idea may seem a horrible one to many people, yet the fact exists, and the remedy in such cases is very simple. Let the two easily drained mortals separate from the other, and let some other mortal who possesses a superabundance of vitality, as many people do, supply the unconscious vampire with the life essence he or she may require. But to return to the question of the best means of disposing of the corpses of mortality. Doth it not seem to you desirable for all reasons to hasten as much as possible the disintegration of their particles, rather than leave them to the slow process of a loathsome decay, whether you dost make of them poor mummified relics of the departed, or suffer them to corrupt the soil in which they are buried? As the angel ceased to speak, I looked at the lonely graveyard lying so still and silent under the dark night sky, with its rocky tombs and its smoldering corpses, its floating astral wraiths and the wandering earthbound spirits who hovered around their earthly bodies, unable to sever the links between themselves and those poor mortal forms for whose indulgence they had neglected to cultivate the higher powers of the souls, so that the starved and stunted spirits could scarce conceive of any life apart from those poor, decaying forms. To the selfish and worldly the links of materiality are as giant links, and for them it would be a mercy to sever by the purifying action of fire, all such material chains. As I thought of the utter uselessness of these embalmed bodies to their dead owners, as I saw how their preservation was a source of danger to dead and living alike, I turned to the angel of the Golden Star, and said, "Yea, you art right. Better a thousand times the fiery sepulchre that my beloved had found within yonder blazing temple than that dead and living alike should be exposed to the horrors of such a state of things as you hast shown me." Chapter 22. The Greek Philosopher. The Little Shrine. Abubatha again. Why his progression as a spirit had been slow, how a sensitive should be trained. The faults of priests and magicians, how medial powers are useful in spirit world. Once more we resumed our rapid flight, and it was with strangely mingled feelings of interest and regret that I recognized one familiar country after another as we passed. Very soon we alighted amongst a range of lulls overlooking a city of the Greek Empire. Here we found a house of modest yet picturesque appearance, surrounded by fine trees and a small shrubbery, in which were placed many graceful statues surrounded by beds of fragrant flowers. The dweller in this house was a man well on in middle age, whose calm noble cast of feature at once attracted me. He was seated at a table with every variety of scientific apparatus then known about him, and scattered on the shelves of the room I noticed many rare and precious books. I saw at once that he was a deep student of all nature, and I observed that many advanced spirits were around him, inspiring his thoughts and directing his studies, though he was himself unconscious of their presence. The spiritual atmosphere around this man was calm and clear, and in it were mirrored the great thoughts of the mighty dead who gathered around him. "That," said the angel, "is one of Earth's greatest philosophers, and it matters not whether he believes the thoughts he notes down are his own or whether they are an inspiration from the gods, for they are true thoughts, and embody great truths and noble teachings, and though man may not recognize them now, they will live as vital elements of truth for all time." Again we floated away, and this time we stayed our flight above a small mountain temple, which I at once recognized as the one where I had met Abubatha, and conceived the idea of becoming a prophet. It was in truth no more than a little shrine. The word temple was almost too important to use in describing it, yet in this humble little building, I recognized a far more valuable aid to man's understanding of immortality than in any of the splendid temples I had seen. For here the lamp of truth burned with a pure and steady flame, and the light that supplied it came in almost unbroken rays from the higher spheres. The priests were five in number, each gifted with some spiritual endowment. In the case of four of them, these gifts were of the lower degrees of power, and though of infinite value to their possessors in their daily lives, not of the same spiritual importance as those of the fifth member of this little community, who was a medium of the higher class, and who in consequence led a very quiet, secluded life, never going beyond the confines of the little temple or the sacred grove, which surrounded it. As I have already said, this little shrine stood on the summit of a mountain, where it could catch the first and last rays of the rising and setting sun, and from which an extensive view of the country round could be obtained. Behind the temple there was a small building where the four priests and the sensitive lived, and around it there was a garden tended by all the brothers in turn. Here they could sit and watch the clouds and sky, the hills and fields and trees, and the approaching figures of the occasional pilgrims who came to pay their homage at the little shrine. One of the brothers, as I have said, never left the precincts of the temple, but the others went forth two at a time to travel through the surrounding country, preaching the doctrines of their order, helping the suffering, and performing such minor miracles of healing and divination as their particular gifts enabled them to do. Those who sought for direct advice from the higher powers had to go to the temple to seek for it, and then the response would be obtained through the sensitive who lived secluded there, and whom no one but his priestly brethren ever saw. The simple if somewhat narrow lives led by these priests was at least free from all temptations of ambition and avarice, for their fame travelled not beyond the range of hills and valleys that shut them in on all sides, and the simple herdsmen to whose spiritual wants they ministered were too poor to offer any but the humblest gifts in return. Thus only those who were animated by an unselfish love of their fellow men were ever tempted to come to this solitary little shrine, and its absence of wealth and grandeur was its strongest safeguard against such elements of spiritual deterioration as I had seen rising around the handsome temple of Amurat. While I was watching the little temple, I saw a spirit approaching me, whose exceeding brightness caused me to think at first that he must be from a very high sphere. Then, as he drew aside the mantle, which half hid his face, I saw with a sense of joy that it was my beloved friend Abubatha, whom I had long desired in vain to see. He responded to my salutation with great affection, and in reply to my question of why I had never been able to see him except the one time when I had seen him in that dream on the night of my earthly death, he replied, "At first, Ahimsiman, I lay in slumber, for my spirit was not truly fit for its great change when death overtook my mortal frame. I erred in that I took not more care of my earthly body. I fasted so often that I weakened its powers, and instead of helping to purify my soul thereby, I only caused soul and body to part before I had fully gleaned the full measure of my earth experience, and before my spirit body was strong enough to sustain existence alone. Hence, I was for long weak, and lay in a semi-slumber, unable to communicate with anyone upon earth. When I recovered strength, you was in the temple of Amurat, and around you there were so many strong spirits of this earth plane that I could never approach near enough to show myself to you. After that, your own course of life created a still greater barrier between us, and till that last hour of your earthly existence, I was never able to draw near enough to warn you of the dangers that beset your path. And since you quitted the mortal body, I have not been able to follow your career, and would gladly hear through what experiences the indulgence of your passions had led you." I therefore related to him all that had befallen me, to the moment when my own mad selfishness had deprived me of my beautiful twin soul, whom I knew now under the Greek name of Lanth, twin soul, and whose beauty was of a Grecian rather than an Eastern type. When I related how I had lost her, my feelings so overcame me that I was unable to continue, and once more my good friend strove to comfort me, even as when a boy I had poured my childish griefs into his sympathetic ears. When at last we parted, I left Abubatha with a heart much soothed by his almost womanly tenderness of sympathy, and the thought that I should enjoy many happy hours in converse with him lightened the desolation of my existence. From Abubatha, I wandered back to the mountain of meditation, from whose summit I had reviewed the events of my life, and where I had next seen the angel of the golden star. I had not seated myself upon the mountainside for long when I saw the angel approaching, and as I rose to greet him he said, "Ahrensimen, you dost mourn ever over your lost land, twin soul, but believe me, that vain grief serves not to cure the wound, and you must rouse thyself and look round upon the multitudes whose griefs are no less bitter, and in seeking to comfort others, you wilt find the surest balm for your own sorrow. On earth you may see many unequal unions, though the pure may be mated with the impure, the good with the evil, but in the spirit world it is not so, and until there be a certain measure of equality in the conditions of twin souls they cannot unite. You may have certain qualities or experiences not possessed by your counterpart, and she may have certain others not possessed by you, and yet ye may truly be united, but it can only be so when the varying qualities have reached a stage of harmoniousness in which union is possible. While any elements conflict, ye cannot become as one. Therefore it is that the spirit world is full of waiting souls, the higher spheres as well as the lower. For every soul had its mate, and sooner or later must unite with it. The dwellers of earth are apartment to imagine that theirs is the only real life, and that all the rest of the soul's existence is passed in a condition of shadow-like immateriality. Yet what error can be greater than thus to confound the soul with the coarse envelope of its material life, and fancy that in casting off that, it had put aside all that gave it distinction and individuality. And if the cold senseless body of clay be not the man himself, doth it not follow that the soul must have taken with it all that made his identity? The loves and hates, the passions and desires, belong not to the body but to the soul, and at the severance between them those attributes belong still to the soul, the senseless decaying body feels none of them. And if a man's love is an attribute of his soul, shall it not expand with his soul in the spirit world, and develop with each stage of its development, till it finds its most perfect expression in the spirit spheres? You may take a simple wild flower of the earth and from it develop a most beautiful specimen of that plant, in whose perfection it is scarcely possible to recognize the humble root from whence it is sprung, yet you hast changed none of its component parts. You hast neither added to it nor taken any away. You hast only developed that which was most beautiful and worthy of development, and subordinated those parts whose attributes were less worthy. You hast but applied your knowledge to the study of that plant's possibilities, and from a poor weed scarce worth the trouble of plucking, you hast cultivated a glorious thing of beauty, worthy of a place in paradise. So with the soul. Man on earth is as the wayside weed, yet may he develop into an angel of heaven without leaving one iota of his individuality behind. And the sweet companionship of his twin soul is no less essential to the perfection of his happiness in heaven than it was on earth. But come. I will show you those whose lot is even harder than yours. Chapter 23. I help Zuleika and Artemisia, how progress by helping others. Following out my newly awakened interest in Artemisia and her son, I found myself in a little while beside Selim, wondering much what would be the ultimate fate of one so crippled in his intellectual faculties as the poor half-witted prince. As I approached the place where he amused himself by holding his imaginary court, I saw Zuleika standing with her clasped hands pressed upon her forehead, as much to still the tumult of her thoughts as to shade her eyes, watching the infantile amusements of Selim, who was pretending to receive an embassy of some rival power, and going through all the pantomime appropriate to the occasion. At my approach, she started and turned round, saying, "Is this you, Ahrensimen? Art you come here to add your reproaches to my miserable state? Nay, Zuleika, the time for reproach between us is past. In these regions all are alike too unhappy to add bitterness to another's lot by vain reproaches. Art you come then to seek to awaken again the old ties between us?" said she suspiciously. "I owe you no duty now. Death had severed all ties between you and me, and even were it not so, I cared not for you. Even in the days of your pride and power, I would have given more for one smile from yonder miserable pygmy of a man," pointing to Selim as she spoke, "than for all the love and gifts you lavished upon me. Yea, even now I know of nothing that I can desire so deeply as to be suffered to remain here, where at last I can be near him. O me!" she wailed in a sudden burst of grief that surprised me, "O me! Is there no hope, no help, for him and me? Must we forever live on thus? He, the poor childish creature who smiles so happily at his conceits, and, this miserable degraded object who fears to show myself to him now, that he should shrink in horror from me." "Zuleika," said I gravely and sadly, for her grief touched me, "Zuleika, between you and me the past is dead, the grave has truly closed over all we were to each other in that past, but nevertheless I also suffer, for my share in the passions of those days, and I too would fain undo the evils that have been wrought. If you will go up to Selim, you wilt find that he turns to you as to no one else, disfigured and fallen as you art. His love for you is instinctive, as the love of a child for its mother, but no less deep and tender, and you canst do for him what none other can, for between your soul and his there are the magnetic inks that ever unite the twin halves of the perfect soul, and through your mind he will dimly sense the things he cannot perceive at all with his own stunted faculties. I will show you how to awake his dormant powers, and so atone for my sin in hurrying him from the earthly stage of life, which was destined to develop the first germs of his senses through the medium of his material powers." Zuleika's face brightened with the first look of unselfish pleasure I had ever seen, as she said, "If you wilt help us, Ahimsemen, I would have hope. Well do I know how great are your powers. Nay, it is not on my powers that I shall now rely, Zuleika, I shall be but the medium for others, even as you wilt be the medium for me, who always unseen will yet be working through you." A deep sigh caused me to look round, and I saw Artemisia standing beside us. "Alas," said she, "I also must be ever unseen by mine own child. Yet I too can help to shield him with my love. Ahimsemen, my once enemy, my enemy no more since you wilt help my child, I pray you to forgive me." She bowed her haughty head, and clasping the hand I held out to her in token of amity, bent down and kissed my fingers, while her hot tears like a soothing rain relieved the sorrowful burden of her heart. Those on earth who have had the charge of a poor imbecile child will understand with what feelings we three watched for every sign of the returning intellect. How long and weary and fruitless seemed often our labors, yet how cheered from time to time were we by some sudden gleam of light, some sparkle of intelligence, as little by little the stupefying weight of the animal faculties gave place to the permeating influence of the more spiritual powers, and first one mental shoot and then another burst through the dull soil of the prince's mind. In our absorption in watching, we forgot ourselves, so intent were we upon his progress that we thought not of our own. Yet at times, as I watched Zuleika and the queen, I could not but perceive how the haughty beauty of Artemisia, softened and chastened by her sorrow, came back to the regal features, smoothing away the hard lines of passion and leaving only the spiritual beauty and warmth of her deep love. Zuleika's girlish grace and delicacy of feature came back again with all their old youthful charm, and with far more than their old loveliness, for her beauty now was the truly spiritual beauty of the unselfish soul that has learned to forget self in the love for others. Of these changes, however, both the queen and Zuleika were still ignorant. Zuleika had almost ceased to think of her own looks, save with an occasional pang of regret that her want of beauty should be noticed by Selim. And Artemisia, in the half-jealous feelings she still experienced at having to share with Zuleika the love of her son, forbore to comment upon the change which she perceived stealing over Zuleika. At last the time came when I felt that my share in the work was over. Selim had attained to the growth of power akin to that of a bright youth just entering manhood, and I felt that he must progress henceforth by his own efforts, no longer by mine, and thus I told Zuleika and his mother and bade them adieu for a season. As I turned to go, Zuleika followed me, and touching me timidly on the arm said, "Ahimsemen, my brother in adversity, cannot ye take me with you? If your task is ended, so also must be mine, and I confess I would fain leave now, rather than wait till the awakened perceptions of Selim tell him how fair are the good and pure women of that earth plane upon which you say he is now to dwell, and how haggard and ugly to look upon am I. He clings to me now as to a dear sister. Alas! What if sometime he should turn from me in disgust at reading what I have been?" Her voice faltered, and she turned away her head to hide her tears.